This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the March 20th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Today, being the third Wednesday of March, is an exception to that schedule. Joy LeClaire, host of Forthright Radio, who's usually in this spot on the third Wednesday, traded weeks with me, which means I'm here with you again today while Joy will be hosting Forthright Radio on March 27th and again on April 3rd in her regular first Wednesday time slot. Yesterday, as you all must know by now, was the 10th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, one of the most shameful episodes among a history of shameful episodes in American history, since we and I use the collective we effectively destroyed that country and did so without most Americans giving it a second thought. Adding to that shame is what has become increasingly clear. The Iraq War was engineered by a group of predominantly Jewish neocons, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Scooter Libby, to mention just a few, what Colin Powell referred to as the Jinsa crowd, for what they perceived to be the benefit of Israel. JINSA stands for the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, and since 1976, it has provided a base for some of the most reactionary forces in American politics, including former Vice President Dick Cheney and former CIA Chief James Woolsey. At this very moment, the same group of neocons, most of whom were also part of PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, having paid no price for their crimes and joined by their allies at AIPAC, are pushing Congress to approve another war for Israel, this time against Iran, with no more evidence of weapons of mass destruction than they produced for Iraq. Not surprisingly, the Vende Patrias, who dominate our Congress, seem ready to oblige, even as President Obama, visiting in Israel today, is reportedly hoping to persuade Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to give negotiations with Iran more time, and that if attack was felt necessary, Israel should stay out of it and let the U.S. handle Iran alone, as the Bushes had Israel do in both Gulf Wars. Of Obama's trip in those Vende Patrias, the men and women senators who have no problem selling out their country, more later. This is a time for anniversaries, and last Saturday we had another one. It was 10 years ago, March 16, 2003, 3 days before Bush Jr. launched the Iraq War, that an Israeli soldier at the wheel of a giant U.S.-manufactured Caterpillar bulldozer rolled over and crushed Seattle native Rachel Corrie as she tried to prevent the bulldozer from demolishing a Palestinian home in Gaza. The Israelis, as to be expected, claim that they were not responsible, and her parents have been trying to get justice for her ever since, with no help, of course, from our government or Congress. Destroying Palestinian homes and villages is something that Israelis became addicted to in 1948, and they can never seem to get enough of it. Of course, had they not destroyed over 400 villages and prevented their inhabitants from returning to what the world had long recognized as Palestine, there would probably have been no Jewish state today. At about 20 minutes past the hour, we're going to celebrate another significant anniversary that's coming up in 2 months, and we'll no doubt that we will be the only radio program in all the United States to do so. This May will mark the 50th anniversary of hearings held in 1963 by Senator J.W. Fulbright, the Arkansas Democrat, to determine if the American Zionist Council, which would soon change its name to AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, should, on the basis of evidence produced at the hearings, be forced to register as a foreign agent. That's what President John F. Kennedy and his brother Attorney General Robert also thought, and had the Justice Department initiate proceedings to get the AZC to register, an effort that ultimately failed and would never again be pursued by an American president after JFK's assassination that November. To talk about all of this, I'll be calling on my old friend and frequent guest on Takes on the World, Grant Smith of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy in Washington, who is a reigning expert on the subject and a number of others related to it, that open windows into Israel's questionable activities in the United States and even of our alternative media, that even our alternative media is hesitant to explore. That's at 20 minutes past the hour. In the meantime, let's get some takes on Obama's trip and how the U.S. Senate is preparing the country for another war. If for the mainstream media, Obama's trip is seen as making amends to the Israelis for not having been loving enough in his first term. For the very pro-Israel Washington Post, which is sided with Israel in every dispute between the two administrations. Scott Wilson writes that, quote, Obama will seek to clarify his support for the Jewish state's theory of its historical roots, addressing one of several subtle but essential missteps he is attempting to fix in a second term. The trip, he goes on, is a mission of remedial diplomacy, rather than the kind of specific peace initiative common for previous presidential visits. End quote. One of the more telling sites that President Obama will visit is the grave of Theodor Herzl, the acknowledged father of political Zionism, as well as its policy of ethnically cleansing the indigenous inhabitants of the land that was to become the Jewish state. The site's symbolic weight, Wilson writes, has prompted other foreign leaders to avoid it, but Obama agreed, part of a series of carefully considered moves aimed at repairing relations with America's primary Middle East ally, end quote. What the Washington Post writer is clearly implying is that it is Obama who needs to do the genuflecting, not the Israeli prime minister who has been demanding that the U.S. go to war with Iran on Israel's behalf and whose economy sucks up billions of dollars of U.S. tax dollars and tax-exempt donations every year. Talk about chutzpah. Well, for those who aren't familiar with Herzl's writings, this is from his diary of June 15, 1895, his plan for the Palestinians or the people living in wherever the Zionists chose to set up shop. Quote, we shall try to spirit the penniless population across the border by procuring employment for it in the transit countries while denying it any employment in our own country. Expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly. End quote. Obama will be one of the rare foreign figures to show his respect to this man. According to the knowledgeable Julian Borger, writing in The Guardian of London, quote, Israel will use President Obama's visit to try and persuade the U.S. to carry out airstrikes on Syria if there is evidence that Syrian missiles are to be handed over to Hezbollah in Lebanon, or at least to give full support to Israeli military action to prevent the transfer. He goes on, they want to use Obama's scheduled 5 hours of talks with Netanyahu on Wednesday evening to secure a guarantee of U.S. support for more preemptive Israeli strikes, writes Borger, even if they risk provoking a cross-border conflict with Hezbollah. Netanyahu's office concedes that it is more likely to succeed in securing U.S. support over Syrian missiles than to persuade Obama to share the Israeli prime minister's position on Iran, he notes. There have been many exchanges between the Israeli and U.S. governments in the run-up to the Obama visit, attempting to narrow the gap between their Iran policies. Obama has pledged not to allow Iran to build a nuclear weapon, and U.S. officials say they will know when the Tehran regime takes a decision to make a bomb and begins to assemble it, end quote. Israel, on the other hand, wants the U.S. to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities well before that, when it has a quote-unquote capability of building a nuclear weapon, which is a vague term and could be arbitrarily applied. Despite the fact that the Obama administration does not support Israel's position, thus far 65 members of the U.S. Senate, including California's Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, have signed on to Senate Resolution 65 that deliberately distorts the administration's position, stating that it, quote, reiterates that the policy of the United States is to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon capability and to take such action as may be necessary to implement this policy, end quote. This is not the policy of the United States, which is set by the President and not the Senate, and each and every senator who has signed that resolution knows it. We need to remember is that every one of those senators, every last one of them, voted for the Iraq War, and that includes both Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. As much as Bush and Cheney and all those neocons, these senators have the blood of both Iraqis and Americans on their hands. And yet, here they are again, ready to add the deaths of Iranians and more Americans to their criminal rap sheets. All of these legislators have sworn to uphold the Constitution. It does not mention anything about loyalty to a foreign state, yet here they are declaring, quote, that the United States has a vital national interest in an unbreakable commitment 2, ensuring the existence, survival, and security of the State of Israel, and reaffirms United States support for Israel's right to self-defense, and urges that if the government of Israel is compelled to take military action in self-defense, the United States government should stand with Israel and provide diplomatic, military, and economic support to the government of Israel in its defense of its territory, people, and existence, end quote. What these traitors, and they are nothing less than that, are saying is that should Israel decide on its own to attack Iran, the U.S. would be obligated to join them militarily, as well as committing to veto any U.N. resolution condemning Israel's barbarism and the violation of international law. In one of the resolution's many whereases, the senators reminded Obama that in December 2012, 74 U.S. senators wrote to him, quote, "As you begin your second term as president, we ask you to reiterate your readiness to take military action against Iran if it continues its efforts to acquire a nuclear weapon," end quote. Just to cover their cowardly behinds, however, the very last line of the resolution reads, quote, "Nothing in this resolution shall be construed as an authorization for the use of force or declaration of war," end quote. Come again? If this resolution is not a call for war, then what is it? A cynic might say it's simply a way for AIPAC, which reportedly drafted the resolution, to demonstrate its power over Congress, which it couldn't do, I might add, if it was properly registered as what it is, an agent for a foreign government. It should be noted that both U.S. and Israeli intelligence agree that Iran is not in the process of building a nuclear weapon. We don't hear about that much, though. But last Tuesday, the director of national intelligence, our national intelligence, James Clapper, told the Senate intelligence community that the U.S. believes Iran has a technical capability to make nuclear weapons, but does not know if Iran will decide to do so, saying it's ultimately a matter of Iranian political will. Anyway, in preparation for his trip to Israel, Obama appeared on Israel's Channel 2 last week, and Haaretz's Gideon Levy, a former guest on Takes on the World, was not impressed with his performance. Obama said he wants to connect to the Israeli people, wrote Levy. This he actually did well. He told Israelis what they wanted to hear. But from Obama, we could have expected a lot more. When Obama said he admires Israel's core values, which values was he talking about? Dehumanization of the Palestinians? The attitude toward African migrants? The arrogance, racism, and nationalism? Is that what he admires? Don't separate buses for separate buses for Palestinians remind him of something? Doesn't two communities living on the same land, one with full rights and the other with no rights, ring a bell, as they say in America? To admire core values, continues Levy, while knowing that we're talking about one of the most racist countries there is, with a separation wall and apartheid-like policies, means betraying the core values of the American Civil Rights Movement that made the Obama miracle possible. Too bad he can't fulfill his fantasy of wearing a fake mustache and wandering around to have conversations with Israelis. He would hear how they talk about blacks like him. Too bad he can't sit in a cafe and, quote, just hang out, as he'd like. He'd hear which core values really move Israelis, end quote. That's from Gideon Levy in Haaretz on Sunday, an Israeli speaking. Obama also plans to make a visit to Ramallah and visit with Palestinian unelected President Abbas, and to Bethlehem to visit the Church of the Nativity. In Bethlehem, former guest on Takes on the World, Mazen Kumpsia, writes that a small bulldozer has removed a stone monument of a map of historic Palestine and the olive tree at the entrance of the city. This was not done by the Israelis, however, he writes, but by the Palestinian Authority from higher up, but via the mayor of Bethlehem. Instead of the olive tree in the map, the idea is that Mr. Obama will see a new thing, a dove at the entrance of Bethlehem. The people gathered there and became angry and tried to stop the work. Some said the Palestinian Authority was acting as a subcontractor for the Israeli authorities, and PA, Palestinian Authority security personnel still patrol the refugee camps to prevent young people from challenging the Israeli occupation, and PA security officials still cooperate with the Israeli security officials. They arrest Palestinians in the West Bank, added Kumpsia, especially those affiliated with Islamic movements, and they ensure that people who get government positions are loyal members of one faction, Fatah. The announcement of Obama's itinerary upset Israel's settler community and his supporters here in the U.S. when the invitees to his speech to Israeli students in Jerusalem excluded those from Ariel, a new, quote, accredited, unquote, Israeli university in the West Bank, and that he will not be speaking in the Knesset, where a walkout was threatened if he did not announce the release of Jewish-American spy Jonathan Pollard, who has since become an Israeli citizen. There are signs all over Israel calling for Obama to release Pollard, who sold masses of top-secret documents to the Israelis in the 80s before he was apprehended and sentenced to life in prison. Another Jewish-American, former NASA scientist Stuart Nozette, was just sentenced to 13 years in prison, a story I suspect you haven't heard about, when he was recently convicted of trying to spy for Israel in the FBI sting in which U.S. agents posed as Mossad agents. What's curious is that at one point, Nozette had told what he thought were Mossad agents that he thought he was already working for quote-unquote you guys, and that despite admitting to the FBI that he sold classified information to the Israelis, as you will hear in the audio of a video clip I'm about to play for you now, Israel's role in the affair was kept out of the case. On March 21st, 2012, excuse me, 1 year ago tomorrow, prosecutors played an FBI surveillance tape in court of Nozette agreeing to sell the U.S. government secrets to Israel. The video was obtained by today's guest Grant Smith of IRMEP under the Freedom of Information Act and is now available on YouTube and at IRMEP.org. In 2007, the FBI discovered that between 1998 and 2008, a nonprofit run by Nozette received $225,000 in consulting fees, from Israel Aerospace Industries. IAI asked Nozette to obtain technical data beginning in November of 98. Nozette complied with the request in exchange for, quote, regular payments, according to criminal complaints filed in court. Here's a 3-minute video of Nozette agreeing to become a paid spy for what he believes is the Mossad. While I get Grant Smith on the phone, here it is.
Okay, so I gave you, even in this first run, some of the most classified information that there is.
Okay.
You know, and so I'm in a, I've sort of crossed the Rubicon in the sense that I can't go back and take a CI polygraph now.
Okay.
You know, so I'm yours. I mean, I've made the commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Now the, so I think when I said like 50K, I think that was probably too low.
Okay, communication. All right.
Do you have anything for me today?
I'm here to discuss any concerns you have.
Right.
This is a great one. We're going to talk about it a little bit more. Any other plans, any other concerns you might have? I'm, before I forget.
Do you have a token for me today?
Before I forget. Absolutely.
Okay. Now the other thing is, I think I've been very good with the cash. I've been able to make it disappear.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about that. I was instructed. Here's a 5 and 5.
Okay, so there's 10.
Yes.
Okay. So, like I said,
not knowing me exactly to the point where you provided all this classified information of value. So, things
so now I've made a career choice.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you know that's my. Pitch. I'm quite. I had a lot. I gave a lot, but now basically I told no one, obviously,
okay. Right.
And I'm going to obviously keep it that way.
Mm-hmm.
The situation is that I have now that I know what you want. In other words, there's a little bit of iteration.
Okay.
I know what you're looking for. I have RF program alone. I gave them samples.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm prepared to give them the whole thing.
Okay.
Okay, that's everything. The whole, all the technical specifications. But it's a big set of files. You know,
okay.
It's like 8 gig.
Okay.
So.
Is it something that, my concern, do you keep it at home? Where is it? I mean,
well,
I want to make sure that it's not compromised. Not
no.
compromised by U.S. authorities, but I want to make sure it's not compromised by somebody else.
What I've done is I've copied it onto hard disks and put it in a safety deposit box.
Okay. The price. Let's talk about that.
Right.
You said that initially $50,000 that you kind of said would be okay.
I didn't know what you were looking for.
Right. Now that you know I'm looking for classified stuff, how much, what's the price, or what is it that you're looking for?
the cost to the U.S. government was $200
million. Okay.
To develop them all. And then that's not including the launching. Mm-hmm. Integrating the satellites. So
okay.
if you say, okay, that probably brings it to almost $1 billion.
Okay.
But the part of it that's the information, that was to fly. So it says, okay, now you have a flight. So I'd say at least $200 million. So I would say, you know, theoretically, I should charge you certainly, you know, at most a 1%.
And that was Stuart Nozette from a video taken surreptitiously, a former NASA employee, agreeing he thought to becoming a paid agent for Mossad. It turned out to be a sting, and he's now serving 13 years. The Israelis got off scot-free.